Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And as we promised last time, we are back with part two of our Halloween hangover listener mail. We're not usually going to be doing two-part listener mail back-to-back like this, but there was a lot of great stuff that came in over the October season related to our Monster Science episodes. And we're also just using a little help, I think, to get through the Thanksgiving week here.
Yeah, American Thanksgiving is hell. There's no denying it. And we have a number of different things cooking here. We, of course, we're continuing to pump out Stuff to Blow Your Mind. But we also have the Invention podcast launching next month. And we've been researching and writing and recording these episodes so we can start dishing those up.
So definitely keep an eye out for that. Speaking of strange technology and contraptions, I have noticed that Kearney is not only still haunted. Last time we discussed a little bit how he's got a ghost in the machine thing going mm-hmm. on, and his gears are moaning in the night winds a little bit. But have you noticed also a slight elongation of his mouth antennae?
Oh, yes. I never was sure why he had those installed to begin with, but now they are definitely pronounced.
Yeah, they're almost becoming fang-like in appearance. One could wonder if he is undergoing a transformation to robot vampirism.
That may be the case. Before we get going here, too, I want to remind everybody, hey, check out our TeePublic store. That's where you can find some merchandise for the show. There's a store tab at the top of our homepage at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the best way to get to it. We have a number of cool bits of merchandise, logo designs, but also episode-centric designs, including, I am told, there should be some new squirrel-based merchandise in there for you, some nice dark skug content for you to have put on a shirt or a mug or a sticker or what have you, as well as a potential holiday Great Basilisk shirt. So get excited about those. Check those out because buying merchandise like this, it's a cool way to support the show. And of course, if you don't want to spend money supporting the show, you can also help us out for free by simply reviewing the show wherever you have the power to do so.
Yeah, so merch up or give us some stars. Now, should we jump right into our first bit of listener mail from Joshua?
Let's do it.
Okay, this concerned our episode about monster slayers, the slayer tradition. So Joshua writes in to say, "Hi, I'm a first-time listener and I just heard your episode, The Slayer. I studied ancient Near Eastern myth and the Hebrew Bible at the University of Chicago, so imagine my surprise when the first episode I heard focused on the myths that I love. You did an amazing job discussing the stories, and my only correction is that the second A in a, I guess what I pronounced Akkadian, is pronounced with the long A like hey, so that'd be Akkadian." And I guess this, of course, refers to the ancient Mesopotamian culture, the Akkadians. So Joshua continues, "There is one thing particularly interesting about the Enuma Elish," and this is, of course, the ancient Mesopotamian creation epic where you've got the battle between Marduk and the sea dragon Tiamat. Joshua writes, "There is one thing particularly interesting about the Enuma Elish that I wanted to tell you about. Tiamat, the monster who is slain in the story, is the sea goddess. The hero who slays her is the storm god. When he slays her, he summons his winds." You remember the evil wind, Robert.
Mm-hmm.
She swallows them, and then he shoots an arrow at her belly, and she pops like a balloon. This causes her body to be cut in half, and dry ground appears on which we live. In the creation story in the Bible, before anything existed, there was just a chaotic void, tohu and vohu. God created the heavens and the earth by gathering together all the waters from that void and then separating them to let dry ground appear. When we picture the biblical creation story within the context of our cosmology, we tend to picture a puddle of water floating in space, then a hole appears in the middle and dry ground rises from the hole in the puddle. But in the context of ancient Near Eastern cosmology, it's better to picture outer space as nothing but water. Think of an aquarium filled with water. Floating dead center in the middle of the aquarium is an upside-down glass bowl with a lid. We live in the bowl, standing on the underside of the lid. Everything outside the bowl is water. This is why the Hebrew word rakia means both sky and a solid hammered surface. I think this is where we sort of get the idea of the firmament, right?
Yeah.
That there's like a solid surface up in the sky that you could walk around on. Observationally, this works from the perspective of a person standing on the bowl's lid. The sky is the color of water because there's water up there. The sky reaches down to the horizon. If you drill into the earth, you find water. And if you go far enough on land, you find the terrible, chaotic, primordial water, the ocean. This explains why the storm god was often the chief god. Storms weren't events when the storm god caused destruction for humans and needed to be placated so he wouldn't wipe us out. Instead, they were battles when the primordial waters above started falling back down, threatening to fill the bowl. The storm god used the strength of his winds to reinflate the bowl, pushing the primordial waters back up above the solid sky, keeping the bowl open for us to live in. Perhaps it's counterintuitive for us with our cosmology, but in the cosmology of the ancient Near East, humanity should thank the storm god for constantly inflating the bowl and saving us all from drowning. So in my mind, the point of the Enuma Elish was to tell the Akkadians, don't be afraid of terrifying storms. Instead, you should fear the day when the waters fall and there is no storm, because that will be the day when it all comes crashing in again. I could go on, but this is too long already. Anyway, great job, and I'm excited to keep listening. Thanks. Now, Robert, this raises this is a fantastic email, by the way. I love all this insight on the ancient Near Eastern cosmology, and this fits pretty well with a lot of what I've read about their kind of view of the shape of the cosmos and stuff. But one of the things that I hadn't considered before is that given all of this, should we in fact picture the events of the Enuma Elish somehow happening underwater? Like if the earth hadn't been created yet, if there wasn't yet an inflated bowl, was this all somehow under the primordial total ocean of the void?
Maybe this is why the deep sea peril movies of the 90s resonated so, is that they kind of connect with a primordial cosmology. The idea that our existence is essentially a deep sea habitat.
I like that. Or wait, are you talking about the 90s or the 1988, 89 underwater movies?
Oh, wait,
movies?
It was more like 89.
Yeah, 89.
But the enthusiasm and the VHS enthusiasm, of course, spills over to the early 90s,
right, yeah. Okay. You're talking The Abyss, Leviathan, Deep Star 6, Lords mm-hmm. of the Deep, all that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Because I know that's your jam.
Because essentially all those story tales are encapsulated versions of the surface world beneath the deep.
Yeah.
But
they're also stories about space. They're like Leviathan is just alien underwater in a way.
Right.
Again, making the connection between the ocean and the space beyond.
Very nice. I love this.
No, I'm thinking of some obvious reasons that my guess about the Enuma Elish here doesn't really make sense, because obviously there are winds, and so like there wouldn't be winds underwater, would there be?
Well, but there are winds underwater in a sense. We do have tides and currents
I guess.
And of course, we also have the movements and migrations of marine species.
Mm-hmm.
Not that all of that would necessarily be known to ancient peoples, but some of it would be, especially if they were seafaring.
Well, I also think about the deep sea braving nature of other ancient Mesopotamian heroes. Like if you think of the Epic of Gilgamesh, one of the mm-hmm. feats that Gilgamesh does is he walks down to the bottom of the ocean to get like some kind of sacred plant he needs. I can't remember quite why he needs it, but he needs a plant down there. So he just like walks down to the bottom of the sea, he gets it, and he comes back up.
Hmm. Well, of course, that reminds me of some of our discussions in the Ancient Aliens episodes.
Oh, yeah.
About the idea that first contact occurs with some sort of entity that arises from the deep.
Oh, yeah. So this was something Carl Sagan talked about mm-hmm. in his work. Now, of course, like us, Carl Sagan did not credit the idea of ancient aliens, didn't believe in, the Eric von Daniken ideas and stuff
right.
like that. But he was asking the question of, okay, if Earthlings had been contacted in the past by ancient aliens, what would the evidence look like? And the closest thing he and his co-author thought they could come up with was this – I don't remember. Was it Sumerian? I think it might have been like a retelling of some Sumerian epic or something. It was some ancient Near Eastern epic about these beings that came up out of the water and brought culture to the people.
Oh, what was the name of that entity again?
Oannes.
Oh, yes.
Or Adapa, I think.
Yeah. I just love that. I find the mythic image of it all the more haunting.
Yeah. That's great stuff. Anyway, well, thank you, Joshua. That was an awesome piece of listener mail, and we really appreciate the clarification of the shape of the world. Now, should we explore another response to the Slayer episode from maybe this one from our listener, Taylor?
Yes, this was another great piece of listener mail. Taylor writes, "Hello, Robert and Joe. I absolutely love the Monster Slayer episode. I really like how you tied in the fear and courage aspects of the episode. I would like to share a personal experience of how a fictional tale of heroics can really change the way you respond to a threat or whatever is generating the fear response."
We actually asked that question in the episode, whether there's any evidence that thinking about mythical heroics makes you more courageous. And we didn't find any evidence or like research on that, but it sounds like Taylor has an anecdote here.
Yes. Taylor continues, "I am a combat veteran and served in Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan. We were relieving a unit that was taking heavy casualties and they were withdrawn. In their stead, we took on the task of finishing what they had started, and I will spare the details of the actual mission. I was a combat engineer, and I would sometimes spearhead infantry platoons with a handheld mine detector sweeping for explosive hazards. I have to say, fear was part of an everyday phenomenon that I experienced, and when I was minesweeping for improvised explosive devices and old anti-personnel mines, I was especially fearful, but I had to somehow overcome this fear in order to complete my role in the mission. The whole time, I could only think of what I was doing to prevent a catastrophe from taking place by detecting these hazards, and I actually recall the heroics of the old Lord of the Rings series to give me a boost in courage. We had a laptop that we watched movies on and had watched all three Lord of the Rings films several times. Many acts of bravery took place in those stories, but some stuck with me. Boromir's sacrifice was one, and Eowyn was another. I personally had always felt a small part of guilt for taking part in a war I knew little about, albeit I joined the army to pay for school, and I didn't realize the actual reality of deploying. For some reason, my morals had always led me to believe that war was inherently wrong. The guilt had always played a role in my fear to die for a reason I did not fully understand. What was I contributing to humanity by being part of all this? I felt a little helpless, and I took myself out of the big picture and downsized to my immediate circumstances, which were my fellow humans. If I were to die, then let it be for my fellow humans, the ones I was sharing this unfortunate experience with. For some reason, I could clearly recount Eowyn's bravery against Sauron. She was no superhuman or legendary warrior, but just a human woman who only wanted to protect those she loved. Her love for her friends and family gave her the courage to overcome Sauron and stab him in the face. Sauron, to me, was acting like a metaphor for these destructive devices, some placed by Taliban soldiers and others left from previous wars. Like Sauron, these things laid in wait for the right moment, then inflicted terrible destruction on those who came across them. These things did not discriminate and killed not only soldiers in the war, but also helpless locals. I used these fantastical stories of bravery to help me through some of my ordeal in Afghanistan, and even though I knew they were all fictional characters, they had played a vital role in inspiring me to face my own fears and overcome them. Sorry for the long response, but it felt good to share these considering I don't get to talk about it much. Thanks for the wonderful episode, and I look forward to the rest of October's podcast. Cheers from Alaska.
Well, Taylor, thank you so much for getting in touch. These were really some fascinating insights. I don't know if I've ever heard that directly. It seems like a kind of common thing to be inspired by heroics from stories to do something actually, you know, requiring of courage in real life. But I can't think of examples other than what Taylor has just given us here.
Well, what I love about this example is, of course, that it's from a combat scenario. So it's a thing that, you know, I don't have any personal experience with. But it, of course, it's always great to hear from our listeners who do, because they can put new twists on topics such as this. And
it's actual physical courage, by the way. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the kind of courage I was thinking about people needing in that episode was more mundane, day-to-day courage. Like, you know, if you have a fear of public speaking, you've got to somehow get up the guts to do it for a work scenario or something like that. Or, you know, those kind of mundane things. But here you're actually talking about putting your life on the line.
Yeah. And I also like the idea of associating Sauron with just sort of the nature of war, you know, like it's ultimately what the great enemy is all about.
Now, at the risk of being doubly wrong, I think some of our more nitpicky listeners might say, I think the character Taylor is thinking about there is the Witch King of Angmar who gets stabbed in the face by Eowyn. Is that not the case?
I believe that is the case, yeah.
Because but looks exactly like, I mean, it's one of Sauron's generals or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, stabbing the Witch King in the face is like stabbing Sauron in the face.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Climb that tower and stab the eye? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, there's no face for stabbing there. So, but we knew what Taylor was talking about.
Here. Yeah, sorry. I did not mean to nitpick. this is a great story.
Yeah, and it ties in because we are going to have other listener mails in this episode that involve the Lord of the Rings.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, man, we have got so many excellent pedantic Tolkien nerds out there. I just had to say that or I knew that we would get a flood of listener mail about, like, that wasn't Sauron. We love you. We love you. Anyway, thank you so much, Taylor. And feel free to get in touch again. Okay, our next piece of listener mail comes from Zolt. Zolt says, hello, Robert and Joe. And this is also about the Slayer, by the way. I was writing to you about one part of the recent Monster Slayer episode. In the episode, you mentioned that babies have been shown to be afraid of spiders and snakes, and that's a type of fear that sticks around, unlike the fear from bears or other predators. I don't really have any proof of my idea. It just makes sense to me intuitively. If a baby or a youngster is left alone in nature for a while, or just not looked after that closely by the parents, and it is afraid of snakes and spiders, it has a survival advantage. If a venomous snake comes along and the baby picks it up and tries to chew on it, it will most likely get bitten, highly reducing its chance of survival. So fear of snakes or spiders being hardwired even in infancy can increase the survival rates of young humans and animals. On the other hand, if a bear, wolf, or lion or any other large predator comes along, the baby has no advantage if it is afraid of them. Obviously, if the baby doesn't make any noise, it has a higher chance of not being noticed, but that would require a higher, more specific type of recognition to differentiate between large predators or members of its own species or even its parents based on limited information. And babies are not really known for being quiet when it would be ideal. So being inherently afraid of bears doesn't give infants much survival advantage, so it wouldn't develop evolutionarily and it wouldn't get hardwired into our brains. Anyways, just an idea. Keep up the good work and greetings from Hungary. I can maybe see what you're talking about. That's a possibility to consider, like that the question is like why snakes and spiders specifically, especially when they're not the most threatening animals out there. Mm-hmm. And the idea could be that if this is a hardwired instinct kind of fear instead of a learned cultural fear taught by the parents, then that could be advantageous to very young children because those animals are not predatory. So they would not be usually seeking to like attack a baby. It would be more like if the baby stumbles across them that right. they would be dangerous.
They would need to know to leave it alone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whereas like a leave it alone instinct just wouldn't really matter in the case of a large predator that wants to eat you because right. you're not going to get away from it.
And if they were to get away from it, it would be the domain of the parents. They would be the ones who would have to stick them into a cave or a tree or however it happened in Clan of the Cave Bear. I want to say it was stuck her into some sort of a enclosure where the bear mm-hmm. could only scratch at her.
Yeah.
Been a while since I've seen it.
I've never seen that one.
Basically the same idea that's explored, I think, in one of the Ewok movies.
Which one? The one with Wilford Brimley?
Maybe. That's the one I've seen the most. I think maybe that's the one because that's the one where she loses her parents and her entire family. They just kill off the entire family and bring in Wilford Brimley.
That's horrible.
But I think they shove her into a tree trunk or something to save her from some wild beast.
Well, at least she got a consolation, Brimley.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting idea, Zolt. Yeah, I'd have to think about that, see what some evidence for or against that would be. But yeah, we're thinking about. Thanks.
All right. On that note, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, more listener mail.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product. And yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first of its kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
Okay, we got a big email covering several topics from our listener, Dan. Robert, do you want to read part of that one?
Sure. I'm just going to read parts of it, and I'll explain why. Dan writes in and says, "Hello, Robert and Joe. Newish fan here. I found about your podcast back in March of this year and have been listening to you since then, gorging myself on your mercifully vast back catalog, heedless of date, like Baker's Gods, R. Scott Baker's Gods. I scan your timeline as a single moment. Before I get along, I just wanted to say I find you guys, and prior hosts too, can't forget them, to be phenomenal, and wanted to thank you for being consistently insightful, well-researched, informative, and at times hilarious."
Oh, thank you, Dan.
"Stuff to Blow Your Mind is without a doubt one of my top-tier podcasts. You guys bring science to the average person in a way few do, and will not, no doubt, be classed as one of the better methods of science communication and application to everyday life, thought, and fiction of this generation of podcasters." Now, at this point in the email, Dan goes on to ask and bring up a couple of issues that have a lot to do with the specifics of R. Scott Baker's Second Apocalypse saga.
Uh-huh.
The way the gods work in it, the way one might potentially take Julian Jayne's bicameral mind hypothesis and sort of fold it into at least one aspect of Baker's work. I really enjoyed chatting with him about this, and it makes me want to go back and maybe check out a few of these things again in Baker's work. I do want to pick up on his third point that he brought up in the listener mail. He says, "Moving on, I don't want to take up too much time, so I'll keep it simple. Way back in one of your episodes on space, not helpful, I know, I think it's the moons of Jupiter or Saturn, sorry, you mentioned how you don't see slow-acting, slow-thinking monsters or aliens in fiction that often."
Oh, I think this was the moons of Saturn episode because we were talking about aliens that might live on the extremely cold moon of Titan.
Ah, right? That was it.
If they're in a cold environment, they might have a very slow metabolism and slow everything.
Well, Dan goes on. He says, "I was reminded of the Watchers in William Hope Hodgson's The Nightland."
Hmm.
"To summarize briefly, in The Nightland, the sun is dead, the stars are gone, and humanity survives within a gigantic miles-tall pyramid and is beset by monsters, both from billions of years of evolution in the endless dark and of a supernatural variety. The five Watchers are only quickly described, and not well, at the start of the novel. What is clear is that they are vast, seemingly mountainous beings that move on a timescale charitably described as geologic, slowly advancing upon the aforementioned Great Pyramid. They are also referred to as some of the most dire beings known to man, hinted at being the coordinating powers behind the otherworldly monsters within the land. They've been known about for millions of years, advancing slowly over the epics all that time. Later fan works extrapolate the Watchers, and given various contextual clues within the book, have cobbled together an interesting handful of takes on these Titans of the Dark. The interpretations range a fair bit, but my favorite was that they were gigantic colony creatures, the Nightland itself possibly being a long dried ocean floor, whose life force has been summoned by demonic agencies. In essence, the Watchers are slowly growing mountains of demonically possessed coral. incrementally inching toward humanity, presumably by growing towards the light of their souls gathered in a single location. I figure that's a lot slower than the Ents, and certainly a monster to be afraid of, albeit in a more abstract fashion. Anyway, you guys rock. Love the recent episodes on the Basilisk and classics like Being Doomed to Repeat History, and especially The Science of It from last year. You guys do great work, and I look forward to many more years of having you dwell in my ears, secreting knowledge and interesting connections. Take care, and all the best.
Well, I have never read this, Robert. Have you, the Nightlands?
I have. It's been a while since I read it, and I forgot about the Watchers. But the Nightlands is an awe-inspiring early work of post-apocalyptic science fiction, mm-hmm. and it is a challenging book to read because it is written in a very antiquated style. It's easy to grow frustrated with it. I know I grew frustrated with it when I read it initially. I need to give it another rereading, though, because buried within the at times challenging prose, there are some just fabulous dark fantasy and sci-fi ideas, a lot of it regarding, again, as he described, the last redoubt, this enormous pyramid in which the last of humanity is living out its dying days against the horrors of a dark, cold earth.
It's a great concept, and I especially love the idea of like a menacing coral that
yeah.
is just – that's wonderful.
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with any. I've never read any fiction that kind of springboards off of the Nightlands.
Uh-huh. Oh, so. Wait, was that from the fan fiction or the fan?
Yeah, I believe so. Or not necessarily fan fiction, but just, you know, short stories that continue the tradition in the same way that a lot of writers write within the mythos of H.P. Lovecraft. But I think that's one of the values of the Nightland is that there are these elements in there that are not necessarily given a lot of time, and you're like, wow, what is that about? Wait, don't tell me about this character's love story and his pining for this lost love. Tell me more about the Watchers in the night.
Well, yeah, I always love when somebody can come up with what feels like a truly original kind of monster mythos, something that isn't just like basically a variation on the vampire or something.
Yeah. Again, The Nightland, William Hope Hodgson, it's out there. You can buy copies of it. It's on Kindle. But it is an original work. There are things about it that haven't been retrod in fiction in the decades since it came out. There's a lot of original wonder there to be had.
Okay, this next piece of mail comes from our listener Michal or Michal, M-I-C-H-A-L. I'm not sure how you pronounce that, but this is following up from the Vampire Clinic episodes. So I think I'm going to say Michal. So Michal writes, thanks for the great and creepy content this October. I was listening to your vampire podcast, and I have remembered a story that a guy I was working with a few years ago told me. Oh, I love a third-hand story from a guy you used to work with. All right. Michal writes, so I am Polish, and I've been living in a small Polish town almost my entire life. Growing up surrounded by woods, bogs, and misty riverbanks, and having a family which enjoys spooky folktales worked out really good for me. I mean, I like a decent scary story. But I'm getting a bit off topic. The guy I have mentioned used to help out local archaeologists with their dig sites as a voluntary passion project. They have found a medieval graveyard once, which is located on a church land but has been forgotten and discovered again by these archaeologists. My colleague told me that there were about 20 bodies buried in that cemetery, all ordinary skeletons, but one which belonged to a person people who buried him believed to be a vampire. That skeleton had his head chopped off and placed face down between the person's legs. Hands and ankles were tied behind his back and bound together. And here comes the creepy part. Oh, that wasn't creepy before?
Yeah.
Here comes the creepy part. The skull had a huge stone jammed into the mouth, jaws broken, and most of the front teeth bent backwards from the impact. Those were the kind of precautions Polish people used to take to make sure no vampires will haunt and hunt them at night. I wish you all the best and hope you enjoyed my little vampire story, Michal. Well, Michal, we've read about other stories like that. I think even in one of the episodes we mentioned brick in the mouth vampire burials.
I think so, yeah. But and, I'm delighted to hear another take on it, though.
Yeah, there was, I think, around the same week that our episodes came out, there was another story in the news about a new brick-in-the-mouth vampire grave – I almost say grampire – vampire grave discovered somewhere. What, didn't we see that on our Facebook discussion module or something, Robert?
I believe so, yeah.
Anyway, yes, that is super creepy. So thanks for sharing, Mikal.
I love this legacy of graveyard desecration and vampire prevention. Here's another free idea I'm throwing out there to the cinema world. Everyone loves to remake the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the family in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is heavily into the desecration of graves and corpses.
Right.
Somebody should do one where it's essentially the Chainsaw family versus vampires. And the whole reason they're raiding all of these surrounding Texan graveyards is not because they just love messing around with corpses, though of course they do. It's that they're fighting the vampire menace.
Okay.
Like, that would be wonderful. Get like that sounds like a – if Joe Lansdale hasn't written it already – that would be a terrific story right there.
That is great. Yeah, Leatherface chainsawing off vampire heads.
Yeah, turn him into the hero.
Oh, here it is. Here it is. Bill Moseley, Chop Top, has metal plates in his neck under the skin, which prevents him from being bitten and vamped himself. So they try to bite him, and they just scrape their teeth on metal.
I love it. And then you also rewrite it to where Grandpa's not only the greatest killer that ever lived, he's the greatest vampire killer.
Van Helsing. Yeah. Grandpa is Abraham Van Helsing.
Yeah, he looks old enough to pull it off.
To the United States. And oh my God, this is so good.
It writes itself.
Okay, we take back all the it's free. Now this is ours. It belongs to us. Or I should be fair, Robert. It's yours. It's yours.
No. We can do it. I think we can do this, Joe. We got to get whoever owns the Texas Chainsaw Massacre rights to see things our way.
Oh, I'm sure they'll just give them right up.
All right, we have another bit of vampire lore here from a listener. This comes to us from Joey in Kentucky. Joey writes, "Hey guys, I just finished listening to the first Vampire Clinic episode, and during the episode you mentioned fun scientific explanations for vampirism in fiction, and I wanted to recommend Peeps by Scott Westerfeld. In it, vampirism is a mind-altering parasite, and the story is told from the point of view of a Typhoid Mary-type carrier of the parasite.
Mm.
It's a fun little story with some interesting parasitology facts thrown in. I'd also like to thank you for all the great book recommendations on the show. Basically, every time one of you mentions a book, I write it down. I love Blindsight. That's the Peter Watts book.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm halfway through the Culture series. That, of course, is the Ian M. Banks series. And I've got about a dozen more on my reading list. Keep up the good work, Joey."
I have not read that, but thanks for the recommendation, Joey.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look that up too.
All right. Now, technically, I think this was not Halloween monster content, but really it is. We got quite a few good messages about monstrous squirrels this Halloween season. And so I think we should plow right into those. They fit, right? That's basically monster content.
Oh, yeah. And I imagine we're going to keep hearing about squirrels for some time. This really has those episodes really struck a chord. Like most recently on Twitter, somebody brought to my attention that the new Fallout game, Fallout 76.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
It has radioactive squirrels in it.
Nice.
That attack you.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, people like our social media feeds have turned at least half into people just adding us with squirrel stuff.
Mm-hmm. On the subject of squirrels, I don't recall which episode it was in which I did this. Maybe it was our listener mail episode, but I asked about squirrels in the works of J.R.R. Tolkien.
I remember exactly why this came up. It came up because we mentioned that squirrels had been introduced outside of their native ranges, and there were squirrels pretty much everywhere except Antarctica. And several listeners from New Zealand got in touch with us to say, no squirrels in New Zealand. And so, of course, because the Lord of the Rings films were shot in New Zealand, you were asking, well, are there squirrels in Middle Earth? And oh boy, we got some Tolkien pedantry coming on the topic of the squirrels of Middle Earth.
So we're going to run through some of these and try to acknowledge everyone who chimed in. Patrick, for instance, writes in and says, "There are squirrels in The Hobbit. When speaking of the vileness of Mirkwood, Gandalf talks about black squirrels and other unclean beasts."
But black squirrels are not even mythical animals. That's just like there are black squirrels.
Yeah, but I guess the whole thing is like you go into Mirkwood, the first thing you notice is the squirrels are different. In the same way that the squirrels are a little bit different in like the movie It Follows.
Just northern forest varieties, not southern forest varieties.
Yeah, I'm assuming it's a different variety.
Okay, this next message comes from Daniel. Daniel says, "Hello, I have an interesting perspective to follow up on your squirrel questions." Daniel, I think we'll be the judge of that. about New Zealand and squirrels. "I'm a U.S. citizen and I've been living in New Zealand for the past year, so I have huge exposure to squirrels in my past life, and my wife is actually a conservationist here, so she lets me know about all the difference in species. Not only that, but we recently watched Lord of the Rings in its entirety just before listening to the episode. That I can remember, the only reference of woodland creatures is Treebeard the Ent mentioning to Merry and Pippin how about how rats, not shown, climb his legs and cause terrible tickles. Hmm. But there aren't mentions of squirrels unless he doesn't understand the difference between rodents, which is very possible as he doesn't seem to understand the difference between hobbits and orcs.
Huh.
You remember that?
Yeah, like
Merry and Pippin, the little hijinks hobbits climb up him, like the stoner buddy comedy hobbits.
Mm-hmm.
They climb up him and he's like, are you orcs?
Okay.
That's what I remember from the
movie. That's in the movie.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, my son and I had to pause on our reading of The Lord of the Rings. So I don't recall from previous readings how that actually went down.
Daniel continues, quote, most of the rodents here are ferrets and hedgehogs, though I don't actually know if either of those qualify in New Zealand. I don't think they do. They are not Sciuridae. That said, there is a quote from the books where Elrond mentions, time was once when a squirrel could carry a nut from tree to tree from Rivendell to the Great Sea. I guess talking about when how far the forests used to extend. So Daniel says, squirrels, they are canonical. If you want to follow up on the ramifications this has for the species on the islands of New Zealand, feel free to email back for more details. Well, thank you so much, Daniel. You know what? I'll grant you, that was interesting. I thought so.
I like the idea that so far we're learning that, yes, you have the black squirrels of Mirkwood, but then also Elrond's bringing up squirrels in a very like nostalgic way, like the old forest way. So perhaps the squirrels are just another thing that have been darkened and made perverse by the influence of Sauron. All right, this next one comes to us from Kevin. Kevin says, I just finished the listener mail episode of the podcast and wanted to assure you that Middle Earth definitely has squirrels. I don't recall if there is any mention in The Lord of the Rings, but I do recall their mention in The Hobbit. I did a quick search on my Kindle and the word squirrels is used 5 times. Of note are 2 quotes bearing 3 of these instances in Chapter 8, Flies and Spiders. Quote, there were black squirrels in the wood. As Bilbo's sharp, inquisitive eyes got used to seeing things, he could catch glimpses of them whisking off in the path and scuttling behind tree trunks. A few pages later, they tried shooting at the squirrels, and they wasted many arrows before they managed to bring one down on the path. But when they roasted it, it proved horrible to taste, and they shot no more squirrels. And then Kevin continues, it seems Tolkien's black squirrels are the darkest of skugs.
Now, wait a minute. I know why the squirrels of Mirkwood have black fur. This has got to be a case of like camouflage melanism, like the moths, the peppered moths of like the UK. You know, when there was a lot of soot on the tree trunks, the moths darkened, so it would be harder to see them standing out against, in contrast, the tree trunks and the surfaces they sat on. Right, as the trunks darkened. Of course, in Mirkwood, the trees are very dark, so the squirrels want to blend in so as not to be plucked off of the branches by spiders and eaten.
Hmm. All right. So, what about the taste? Why they taste so bad?
Just because all squirrels taste bad.
I don't know. I've never eaten one.
It has nothing to do with them being from Mirkwood.
I assume squirrels could probably taste good. Didn't we hear from some people who'd eaten squirrels?
I think we did, yeah.
I mean, in the right stew, right? I mean, that's kind of the one assumes.
Maybe this was just their mood affecting their perception of the taste of the squirrels.
And we have one more here from Fred that writes in and says, great show. Question, are squirrels mentioned in The Lord of the Rings? Yes. And then he includes a quote here. Whether because of Strider's skill or for some other reason, they saw no sign and heard no sound of any other living thing all that day, neither two-footed except birds, nor four-footed except one fox and a few squirrels. And Fred says the response, 10,000, I would imagine. Well, not quite 10,000, but you did add to our new collective understanding of the squirrels of Middle Earth.
I'm still grooving on my camouflage hypothesis. The gears are grinding in my head. Prove me wrong out there. Prove me wrong.
Well, on that note, we're going to leave the squirrels of Mirkwood behind, and we're going to take one more break. But when we come back, more listener mail from October.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save.
No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. All right, we're back. Now, this piece of mail concerns our vault episode about carnivorous plants. We talked about this was an episode we recorded a couple years ago, I think, about the like legends of human-eating trees and stuff like that and how that connects to actual carnivorous plants. And so our listener, Sean, got in touch to say, "Hi, Robert and Joe. My name is Sean, and I'm a researcher studying angiosperm, flowering plant evolution, and comparative genomics at the Lebensmack Institute at the University of Georgia. I've been listening to the podcast for the past year during my commute and have enjoyed every second, and I wish I had found it earlier. I just listened to the episode From the Vault, Carnivorous Plants, and was intrigued because one of the grad students in the lab studies speciation, hybridization, and evolution of Sarracenia pitcher plants." I hope I said that right.
I find carnivorous plants fascinating due to the fact that carnivory in plants has evolved independently several times through convergent evolution, which I think is really cool and interesting. One thing that I was surprised that you guys didn't mention is the fact that many carnivorous plants lure insects by reflecting UV light. Insects like ants and flies are sensitive to blue and violet light. We'll see these plants emitting a blue fluorescence and are lured toward them. The reason why is yet to be understood, but it is a cool predation strategy that's invisible to us humans. Sean also offers that if we're ever interested in doing something on the evolution of flowering plants, we could get in touch. But also, Sean writes, furthermore, there's a lot of cool plant research, i.e. evolutionary biology, transgenics, plant pathogen interactions, and much more happening here in the plant biology department at UGA. And I'm willing to help you guys get in contact with the professors who would share their research. Finally, I'd like to say thank you again for making my commute more enjoyable and keep up the great work. Well, thank you, Sean. Yeah, maybe we should look into flowering plants sometime.
Yeah, and I love the idea of dipping into more local talent. We've been trying to do more of that, of bringing experts on the show, not via telephone, but actually get them in the studio. And there's so many great minds in the Atlanta area. We should do more of it. All right, at this point, we're going to move on to some listener mail that is related to our episode, The Curse.
How about this one from Taylor? What do you think?
Let's go for it.
All right. So Taylor writes, in your episode about curses, you pondered whether or not there could be legal ramifications for uttering a curse on someone. In Canada, we actually have a law which would impact cursing someone in limited situations. Section 365 of the Criminal Code of Canada is entitled Pretending to Practice Witchcraft. It states, everyone who fraudulently A, pretends to exercise or use any kind of witchcraft, sorcery, enchantment, or conjuration, B, undertakes for this consideration to tell fortunes, or C, pretends from this skill in or knowledge of an occult or crafty science to discover where or in what manner anything that is supposed to have been stolen or lost may be found, is guilty of an offense punishable on summary conviction.
Oh, I already have so many questions about this regarding like what the difference is between practicing a religion and pretending to practice a religion. But we'll wait to the end of the email to bring it all up.
Okay. Quote, this law only applies if you are fraudulently doing an activity and therefore goes to the mens rea of the act, e.g., if you act as a psychic and you believe you are a psychic, then there is no crime. Whereas if you act as a psychic solely to take money from a believer, then you have committed a crime.
Okay.
How would you determine that? That'd be so difficult. Anyway, how would this apply to curses? I can think of two scenarios where this law may come up. Scenario number one, you, not believing in curses, know someone who has a strong irrational belief in curses. You do not like this person and want to cause ill will on them, and despite not believing in curses, you cast one on this believer. It causes a severe negative downturn in this person's mental well-being, physical well-being, or their financial well-being because, of course, they must find someone to dispel this curse. You will be guilty under Section 365 of the Criminal Code of Canada. Maybe if you like write out a manifesto stating all your plans, I don't know.
Yeah, you would have to. They'd have to catch your villainous admission of guilt on tape or something.
Yeah, you'd have a Bond villain monologue. Yeah. Of course, it would make it not efficacious, right? If you actually monologue to the Bond you were cursing.
That's true.
Scenario number two, you, not believing in curses once again, accept funds from someone to dispel a curse which this person believes has fallen on them. This person may be working in conjunction with the you in scenario one to extort money from this person. In this scenario, once again, there is clear fraud on your part and you will be guilty under Section 365 of the Criminal Code of Canada.
Okay.
Of course, this requires very specific circumstances, and if in either of the above scenarios you in fact believe in curses, then no crime has been committed. Seems like this law would never be used for curses, right? Well, someone was charged under Section 365 in 2012 in Toronto for charging thousands of dollars to remove a family curse. Huh. And Taylor links to a source. Slightly different, but a man in 2017 was charged under this section for charging six figures to remove an evil spirit from a family member. And then Taylor links to another source. And finally, in 2015, the Edmonton Police Force had to release a statement warning people not to fall for paranormal frauds, which includes curse removal. I thought you would find this interesting, and I do not know if there would be any comparables in the U.S. There are certainly in the U.S. Fraudulent, predatory practitioners of occult and crafty sciences.
You can turn on the TV and see them every day.
Yeah. The mediums who will like charge you a premium to talk to your dead family members and stuff. I try not to harp too much or be like hating on people who believe in things that I don't think there's any good evidence for. But that is one that really just makes me mad. Like the, you know, selling access to dead family members and stuff like that. That I get kind of furious when I read about that.
Oh yeah, I mean this is the kind of thing that Harry Houdini took issue with.
Yeah,
I mean because really we're talking about the difference between practicing a religion or practicing some sort of supernatural belief system, and simply preying upon those who do.
Yeah,
you know, going after them, trying to milk them for money. And clearly, well, one of those two scenarios is definitely bad.
Yeah,
I think you know anybody out there who is just going out there to manipulate people and prey upon whatever kind of superstitious ideas they might already have, you know, that's deplorable and that should be punishable under criminal codes. But where it gets away from me is the idea of like, well, I can certainly partake in religion and partake in rituals of that faith or belief system without completely believing in it, struggling to believe in it. You know,
people do that every day. A lot of the people going to church, sitting in the pew next to you, might not really believe everything, but they're seeing some kind of value in what they're doing.
Right, and then ultimately, like we discussed, like well, how different is a curse than a prayer? You know,
yeah,
it depends how you're framing it. I guess I've heard some prayers before that sound a bit like curses.
Yes,
you know, and where would that fall under such a ruling? I don't know. It's just all interesting food for thought. This is a really interesting listener mail that we received.
Yeah. Again, with the like selling access to dead family members through a spirit medium or something like this, it's hard to prove fraud in those cases like Taylor mentioned in the email. You need specific kinds of evidence and stuff that probably aren't going to be there most of the time. Though then again, I think about the fact that if you're going to be like a spirit medium – you're probably going to be better at it if you know you were a fraud, because then you can consciously practice cold reading techniques and trickery and all that. Whereas if you actually believe you have power, it seems like you'd be less likely to produce really impressive results. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Now, something worth exploring in a future episode would be to what extent do we have that space between, though, where someone is utilizing these various tricks but doing so from a place of belief. You know, like you're essentially going out there and doing a cold reading, but what if you're doing it and you're believing that these are like the tools of reaching out into the ether and, you know, and connecting with the spirit realm? Like, it seems like it's possible.
Yeah.
But I haven't read anything yet to really answer that for me.
Well, yeah, people's powers of self-justification are incredibly powerful.
Yeah. At any rate, I hope Taylor is considering a future in Canadian curse law because
can you specialize in this?
It sounds like a great CBC show. I would watch the Canadian curse law attorney
curse law practice
show. Yeah,
Abraham Van Helsing, attorney at law.
Now speaking,
that wouldn't be it, would it? Who gets rid of curses?
I'm not sure offhand. Daniel Webster, maybe. I don't know. At any rate, speaking of Van Helsing, though, we did have someone write in, Rolf, who wrote in and said, "Hey, guys, love the show. Mike Mignola, the creator of Hellboy, did some of the character designs on the Dracula movie. The armor is classic Mignola. And if you're looking for some really cool aquatic stuff, check out the comic Low by Rick Remender and Greg Toccini. All the best, Rolf."
I'm not familiar with Mike Mignola.
Oh,
Mignola.
Yeah.
Mignola, I think. Yeah. Mike Mignola, I believe, is how I'd read that. But I do love that armor. I think he's referring to the armor we talked about in Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula movie.
Where Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yes. The Coppola one where he wears this like muscle, looks like exposed raw muscle in the armor, and it's so good.
Yeah, I love Mike's work. I used to read Hellboy. I read the first several volumes of that, The Conqueror Worm being my favorite of those. But then his work also shows up in a number of different film projects. He worked, of course, most notably, he worked with Guillermo del Toro on the Hellboy movies.
Oh, okay.
But his work also shows up, I think, in some other del Toro films as well, set and monster design, that kind of thing.
I only saw the first Hellboy movie, but I remember thinking it had some great design in it.
Yeah, the second one has some tremendous design in it as well. You got, evil fairy kings and queens, that sort of thing.
Nice.
There's some wonderful elements in it.
Okay, well, does that wrap it up for today?
I think so. Let's see. I have one last little bit of email here that's just a general fun email that I just want to read real quick. This comes to us from Chris. I've listened to almost every podcast of you two, Christian and Julie as well. Needless to say, I like the ideas your podcast churns out at a truly staggering rate, despite the colossal amount of time researching must be put into it. A mighty commendable thing it is indeed. My favorite episodes are definitely the ones regarding potentially upsetting or highly stirring philosophical subject matter. The Boltzmann Brain episode, the Mind Flayer episode, the Bicameral Mind, anything with Borges, R. Scott Baker, all ought to be put on a greatest hits CD.
Okay.
When I'm not feeling well, I put on my headphones, turn on some stuff to blow your mind, and start relaxing. He goes on to say, I've been listening for a very long time and I've never written in, but just wanted to tell you folks your work and consideration is appreciated. Right now, I'm reading The Three-Body Problem by Si-Chin Liu, Preacher by Gareth Ennis and Steve Dillon, and Altruism by Matthew Ricard. I'm not familiar with that one.
That sounds familiar. I think that's a book I've seen referenced around.
Excellent. Well, I'll have to check that one out as well. I did read Preacher back in the day, but it's been a very long time.
Glad you're reading Three Body Problem, Chris. I hope you enjoy it.
All right. Well, there we go. Hopefully, we've gotten a lot of the supernatural bugs out of our mail bot here.
Well, now that we've read Taylor's email, I'm wondering if we actually should have paid that Canadian machine exorcist. That may have been a bad call. Do you think we got scammed?
We might have been scammed. I'm not sure. But I think he's doing better. I think he's doing better. So I think we're in a place where we can continue now. We actually have the courage to press on through the holidays and continue to bring some great episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind and some great episodes of Invention as well. In the meantime, check out StuffToBlowYourMind.com. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes, links out to our various social media accounts, including Facebook, where we have that discussion module, a great place to interact with other listeners and also with the hosts here. Again, this is Stuff to Blow Your Mind discussion module on Facebook. Also, StuffToBlowYourMind.com has a link to our merchandise store where you'll find all those cool designs we've been talking about.
Big thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us to let us know feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, let us know where you listen from, how you found out about the show, all that kind of stuff, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.